From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Nice to be back. Tonight, we're going to start out with a new book, Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, Incredible True Tales of Mischief and Mayhem. And the author of that fine book, Paul Martin, is here and is joining us this evening. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Good evening, Dana. I'm fine, thank you.
Whereabouts are you located?
I'm in Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C.
Okay. Well, up here in where I am, in Saskatchewan, Canada, believe it or not, I still have snow on the ground. How about you?
Well, I was up in Minnesota a week or two ago, and they had snow, and I noticed some of the lakes were still frozen.
Yeah, I think it's a conspiracy, but tell us a little bit about yourself. You spent some time with National Geographic, did you?
Yes, I spent a long career there. I was there for 30 years. I worked on several books, and I spent my last several years, in fact, two decades, working on the travel magazine, National Geographic Traveler.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen that book lots, and probably have looked at your work in the past. Now, the book, the title, I love it, Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, The Incredible True Tales of Mischief and Mayhem. What brought you to write the book?
Well, in 2012, I had a book published called Secret Heroes, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World. And that book contained biographies of 30 little-known Americans who'd done just absolutely fascinating things. And when I finished with that, I thought, well, I think I'll flip the coin and write about the other kind of guys, the villains and the scoundrels and rogues. And what I really wanted to do was to break out of just the sort of true crime mold and not just focus on horrific crimes and serial killers. I wanted to have a whole spectrum of all kinds of criminality and rascals and so forth, from pirates to slavers to bootleggers and con men and gamblers. And so I started by jotting down a list of every kind of crime I could think of, and then I looked for the most colorful character in each category.
Paul Martin's here talking about his new book. Now, I always ask authors this. We do a lot of our book shopping now online at the Amazon, and for the listeners, there's a link in the show notes on how to pick up the book. But for those that are in the bookstore that are walking down the aisle, and obviously I've got the book right in front of me, you see the title, it's going to pique your interest. But what about the book, when someone's thumbing through it, is going to you as an author be satisfied that that particular person is going to get what they pay for?
Well, if they have an interest in human foibles and mistakes and of different sorts, I think they'll find an interest in it. What I tried to do is this: the title actually reflects the hierarchy of the organization. The villains, of course, are the worst. They're the most heinous. There are a couple of serial killers in there, and America's worst slave trader. The scoundrels are cut below them, and the rogues were people who might have just gone off the rails temporarily in their life at some point. And so I think there's a nice spectrum in here, and it isn't. I've tried to make it lively and fun, and it's not just recounting one horrific crime after another. In fact, I have to say that after writing about heroes, when I turned to write about villains and scoundrels, it actually was more fun, because with the heroes, you really have to maintain a respectful, almost reverential attitude.
Sure.
But with some of the characters in this book, I could be a little bit irreverent.
Now, we're not going to get into all of the book, but I want to talk a little bit about it, and in particular,
I'm just, Dana, I'm hardly able to hear you.
You can, having problems hearing me? Okay, I'll
turn
this up. Is that a little bit better?
A little bit.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. We'll have to push some buttons here. That's the fun part about live radio. How about that? Is that a little bit better?
It's a little bit. I'm still
Okay.
It's still not quite as loud as it should be.
Okay, I will try and fix that as we go on, but I'll get you started with talking about Chicago's florist mobster. I kind of like that topic, and let's talk a little bit about him.
Well, when I started reading about organized crime, of course, the first thing you come upon is figures like Al Capone and Legs Diamond, a lot of characters like that. But when I was able to come up with this amazing character named Dean O'Banion, who was quite a contradiction. He was an Irish American, and he made his living when he wasn't selling bootleg whiskey as a florist. He loved to do flower arrangements, and he ran a florist shop, and he was such a contradiction. But he actually was linked to the deaths of over 25 men, and he was reputedly the chief of police in Chicago called him the city's arch criminal. Really, before Al Capone rose to power, Dean O'Banion was pretty much the kingpin in Chicago.
When you do the research, how do you find these stories? I've never heard of them before.
Well, that's part of the fun, is digging into these different sources. I mean, there are lots of encyclopedias of crime, and as I said earlier, so many of them tend to focus on the most gruesome they can come up with. There's a wonderful source that I came across when I was researching my first book called American Biography Online, and I found it at the Library of Congress. It's actually a 20-volume set of books that has over 20,000 biographies of Americans, not all criminals, I mean of every stripe of American, but you can search online and find any type of, I mean, you can find bootleggers, and it will give you all the bootleggers of note in the country's history and so forth. So I just did a lot of research on different categories. I would look into, you know, who was the worst slave trader in our country? Who was the most colorful gambler in our country? And a lot of these sources would lead me, you know, it would be a treasure hunt. You'd find one little reference to somebody, and in another book you'd find more, and I mean, that's what the research process is all about, is just digging through layer after layer.
Author Paul Martin's here talking about his new book, Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, Incredible True Tales of Mischief and Mayhem. And you've been in the business a long time, 30 years, National Geographic. This isn't your first rodeo, as the young people like to say. But compare writing 30 years ago to today, and kind of the... You know, obviously you're writing a book, you want people to buy it, it's a business. What about that, comparing yesterday to today?
Well, I think as someone who has spent his entire career in journalism, of course I've seen tremendous changes since, from the 1970s to the present day. When I started out, the epitome of journalism for me at that time was magazines. They allowed you to write longer, more colorful pieces, and that's what I did for a lot of my career. That and working on books. I edited I think 17 books for National Geographic, and long form writing seems to be, at least in terms of journalism, is getting more and more rare. It's the short pieces now. Everything is short and quick. The internet has had a huge effect on that, and everything has to be summarized and delivered in small bites. So that's the main trend I see. It's we've gone from more leisurely long form writing to much more staccato, short, quick hits.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up about social media today and the internet. Is there a what's the term I'm looking for? Is that been a good thing or a bad thing for authors like yourself?
Well, it's good and it's bad, because, quite frankly, social media is one of the most powerful publicity tools that you can get. I mean, Twitter and Facebook to some degree. These are powerful tools to get the word out about your book. Of course, they're not the kind of outlet in which you can do any really extended writing, but they're great for letting people know that your book is out there and what the subject is, and hopefully it'll find a wide enough audience to sell.
Let's get back to the book a little bit, and I want to talk about the lawmen who went bad and the scoundrels part of it, and I'm sure there were plenty to research there.
Bert Alvord was a really an amazing character. Here was a man, he probably witnessed the gunfight at the OK Corral in Tombstone in 1881, the famous gunfight with Wyatt Earp and his brothers facing the bad guys. And in fact, Bert Alvord's father was a lawman himself. And when Bert was in his late teens, he became a deputy sheriff. And for 15 years, he was a sheriff in various towns around Arizona. For some reason, in 1899, he did a 180 and became a train robber. And for the next several years, he and his gang held up two or three trains. Only one of them really netted them much money. But he quickly became one of the most wanted men in the West and was chased all over the West. He finally was caught and put in prison, and when he got out, he left and went to California. Unfortunately, there were enough outstanding warrants for him that people came looking for him in California, and he simply disappeared. After 1905, no one knows what happened to him. But what fascinated me about him is that here was a man who his father had been a lawman. He had a 15-year career in law, and suddenly he just went bad. It's just hard to explain, and nobody really can. Who knows what makes a person change that dramatically?
Absolutely. Paul Martin's here, and we're talking about his new book. Paul, when you look at the public's fascination with history, you know, I'll admit myself, with the 500-channel universe that we have here, I spend a lot of my time on the National Geographic Channel or the History Channel or Discovery, because a lot of what we see today in media, well, for lack of a better term, is just garbage. Let's talk about that a little bit, the public's fascination with history and the past, and how we can keep the past alive, so to speak.
Well, I'm certainly with you. I think most commercial broadcasting is dreadful, and I do spend most of my time watching the Science Channel and History Channel and National Geographic, Smithsonian. Those are just wonderful outlets. And there's something about watching a program that has real content and is based on facts, and whether it be history or even, you know, current information like the latest scientific news. When you get done watching those, you just feel better. You feel like you've done something worthwhile. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like the Big Bang Theory as well as anybody else, and those shows have a place, but it's really great to have channels like the History Channel. In fact, I got several of my characters for my last two books from watching those types of programs.
Yeah, it's again, the public, myself, and maybe it's just, I think you and I are probably close in age. Maybe it's that, but to try and keep it fresh for the young people, the kids that are in school, to learn about what's going on, because today's news cycle is quite depressing, to say the least, and it's authors like yourselves and books like what you have here are doing just that. Now, it's time that we talk about a rogue here a little bit, and I thought I would ask you a little bit about the frugal counterfeiter.
Oh, he was one of my favorite characters. His name was Emmerich Jüttner. He was an immigrant from Austria, and he came to this country and spent the early part of his years working as a a picture framing shop. And when he got too old for that, he retired, and he became a building super in New York City. And in his 60s, he had to retire from that. He could no longer keep it up, and his wife passed away. And he really found himself falling on hard times. He just wasn't able to get by. He tried to make it as a junk collector, and that didn't bring in any money. So he called on some talents he'd learned back in Austria as a young man. He had studied photo engraving, And so when he was 63 years old, he sat down at the kitchen table one day and counterfeited, if you can believe it, a $1 bill. Now, why on earth he would counterfeit a $1 bill is beyond belief, but that is what set him apart. Because he didn't pass any large bills, because he only passed $1 bills, he was below the radar, and he went over 9 years without being caught, which is the longest that any counterfeiter in American history has ever operated. I also call him, and besides a frugal counterfeiter, he was a crook with a conscience, because he never passed one of his fake dollar bills at the same business or location more than once. He didn't want the owners to take a big loss on his account. So he just passed enough of these little fake $1 bills to keep himself a roof over his head and feed himself. What was really the most astounding thing about his money was that the bills were horrible renditions of a dollar bill. He misspelled George Washington's name, and the drawing of Washington didn't look anything like Washington. But because nobody would think of someone passing a $1 bill, people didn't even look at him. They would just take them and go on. So when they finally caught him, he was such a kind of a likable old duffer that he only spent 4 months in jail, and then he was paroled and went to live with his daughter, and that was the end of his of his counterfeiting career.
Now, you've had a lengthy career, and what makes you keep writing?
I'm just not able to hear you, Dana.
You've had a lengthy career, and I apologize about that. I'm not sure what's going on. You've had a lengthy career, but what keeps you writing, Paul? It's time maybe you want to retire, go fishing or something like that, or is it in your blood?
I think it's in my blood, and to tell you the truth, every one of these stories that I've written is like a magazine article. There's a story arc to each one of them, a kind of a grabber lead, and then a little bit of the background information, and then fill it in. And that's what I've pretty much done my whole career. So I'm continuing this sort of magazine tradition in book form. And the people that I select, I have to be really honest, they're people that I personally wanted to know more about, that I found just fascinating. And fortunately, I was able to group them into these interesting categories of villains and of heroes, and I think it's just fun. It keeps me going, you get up in the morning with a spring in your step because you know you're going to head down to the Library of Congress and learn something new that day. So it's just a wonderful way to pass your time.
Now, we've got a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you, with the today's print media kind of, and maybe I'm wrong if I say on the way out, but certainly not the same the way it used to be, magazines, newspapers, etc. The hardcover book, what you like to write, may be all that we have left here in the next little while, or am I over-exaggerating?
I don't know. You read stories quite often about the death of print, and then just last week I read a story in USA Today about how nobody can figure out how to monetize, no publisher can figure out how to make money off the internet, and the admission is, frankly, that print may just be better. I think one little sign of that's hopeful to me is that my two books, only about 10% of the sales of each of these books have been e-books. The rest have been hard copies. So that to me is heartening. I guess it's just my age and my background. I like to hold the book in my hand. It just seems more natural to be reading a book in a book form.
And holding the book in your hand is a good thing for sure. The book is Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, Incredible True Tales of Mischief and Mayhem. The author, Paul Martin, has joined us, and you can click on a link in the show notes. Paul, I apologize for the audio problems, but I do appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Dana.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
That's author Paul Martin, and we'll try and get the the phone issue fixed here in the next little bit. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with Wendy Murphy. Wendy is always a fun to have on the program, and she's going to talk about, well, a certain basketball team owner who's got himself into trouble and some other things. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. It's always a pleasure to have Wendy Murphy on the program. Hi, Wendy. Ooh. Did I lose you, Wendy? Hello?
No, I'm sorry. I can hear you. I just switched ears. I'm sorry, Dana.
That's all right. Everyone knows Wendy is a former sex crimes prosecutor, DA. She's a law professor, does a lot of work on TV. And I noticed something here that you sent me on the email. The WE News, Women's... how do I say this? Women's News?
Women's E-News.
Women's, oh my God, I can't read. Womensenews.org, covering women's issues, changing women's lives. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know what? Can you still hear me, Dana?
I can hear you.
I keep losing you. It may well be not just my ear, but this particular phone. So keep talking. I'm going to switch phones at some point.
Yeah.
Did you say that you read something on a new thing on Women's E-News?
Yes. Well, I'm seeing you on Women's E-News, and tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I'm a contributing editor at Women's E-News, and I have been for a long time. Okay, there. Is that better?
Is that better? I can hear you fine. How about you, me?
Okay, good. Yep. Sorry about that. So I'm a contributing editor at Women's E-News. I have been for a long time, and I do have a new piece there that relates to one story that I think people will find fascinating, not quite the thing you and I were going to talk about, but there's a prosecution underway in New York involving, believe it or not, a man who took secret sex videotapes of women that he was having sexual relationships with, unbeknownst to them, and then doing I don't know what with the tapes, but at a minimum, storing them on his YouTube account. One of those women, to whom he gave his password for that account, uncovered the videos, reported it to police because she didn't give consent to be videotaped, and the police arrested her instead of him for interference with privacy on his computer or some such nonsense. Anyway, it took her about 9 months to make that case go away, and soon after that he was prosecuted and still is being prosecuted in Manhattan. Just this year the charges were finally brought against him for unlawful recording of sexual activities with a variety of women. And you know, it just is an interesting story that, and I wrote about it for Women's E-News because my final sentence in the piece says, what kind of country is this where a man's privacy rights in his YouTube account that he shares with people, in other words, it's not very private, has more protection in terms of law enforcement than a woman's vagina that she's not sharing with the world.
Well, yeah, you've got to wonder, and I hope our audio problems are fixed here, Wendy. I can hear you fine. You've got to wonder about privacy rights and the internet. Aren't you just opening it wide up when you go on YouTube and you go on some of these blogs, etc., that you're kind of throwing your privacy rights out the window?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I'm embarrassed maybe to admit this. Maybe I'm not, maybe I shouldn't be embarrassed, but I don't understand YouTube accounts, so I can't speak to the technology per se, but I suspect a person can have a public section and a private section.
Yeah.
And I don't think people really have that much privacy in even their private accounts. They clearly have more privacy in their private accounts. But the notion that you can put something on the internet, even in a private account, then give somebody access to your private account by sharing your password and then complain about it as if it's a big privacy violation and a constitutionally protected privacy violation, and not even have the decency to acknowledge that filming somebody having sex, which was not by any stretch consensual in terms of being consensually placed in the public domain, is somehow not a problem. I mean, talk about prosecuting the wrong problem. So I think it's a combination of things. But really, Dana, the long and the short of the story is, and I didn't write about it in this academic way for Women's E-News, but it's certainly part of the story that deserves academic attention, and a lot of people do talk about it. The idea that privacy as a legal construct applies with equal force to protect all people's private things is simply silly. You know, it's sort of as hierarchical and political as any other doctrine in law. The more important you are in society, the more we protect your privacy. And women generally and children aren't worthy of a high level of protection. So it's not a surprise to me from a political perspective that the woman's privacy was not respected, and indeed she ended up being prosecuted, which is pretty disgusting. But that, you know, she would not have her rights instantly be seen as more important in the hierarchy of privacy rights compared to his. That's an American problem. It's an American legal system problem that rears its ugly head in a variety of different doctrinal ways. Privacy law is just one of them.
And you can learn more about this at womensenews.org. Now, the reason I asked you on the show is to talk a little bit about a certain basketball team owner that's got himself into some trouble. And Wendy has a new article for the Patriot Ledger called Pro Sports Racism and Money.
Let me correct you right there, Dana, before you go on, and then I want you to do whatever you want to do by way of introduction. It's actually being published tomorrow in what's called Cognoscenti, which is an NPR or WBUR web-based news venue.
Okay.
In other words, it's not going to be at the Ledger. It's going to be at a very nice space called Cognoscenti, cognoscenti.org. WBUR has a link to it, but that'll be up tomorrow.
Right on. Let's talk about Donald Sterling, and I'd never heard of him until all this. What about him?
Yeah, that's how I felt. You know, there are so many of these bad boys in sports that I have never heard of until they got in trouble. Kobe Bryant among them. You know, if you're not in the business, if you're not a fan, you would have no reason to know these people. So I wish that I didn't know Donald Sterling. And, you know, on some level, we all know now who he is, this 80-something owner of the L.A. Clippers, or former owner, I guess, in some ways, who was captured on tape making profoundly racist statements about blacks in general, but including friends of his black girlfriend slash mistress slash whatever the hell she is. And, you know, it's almost too easy to just go after the guy as a racist, because an unapologetic, blatant racist remark from a guy like that, who has no qualms about saying, you know, blacks shouldn't be socializing with whites, whatever his age is, it's just too easy on some level to jump on the bandwagon against the guy. Nevertheless, you know, it's not wrong to jump on the bandwagon either. But my piece, Dana, is trying, I think, to get us unpacked a little from the superficial black versus white fight. And what I mean by that is, I don't just say, oh, come on, don't be racist, and let's all get along and talk about it and so forth, which is, I think, the most common narrative that has come out in the aftermath of the Donald Sterling controversy. What I wrote about was how profoundly simple it is to be racist in America,
right,
when you have a lot of money. And it's not only easy, but blacks themselves will give you permission if you're writing the right checks in the right amount to the right people. Why do I say that? Because Donald Sterling, after getting in trouble for huge problems with racism, not only in his words but his actions, when as the owner of a bunch of apartment buildings, got in trouble by the Department of Justice for intentionally not renting to blacks on the grounds that, quote-unquote, they smell bad, and he just didn't want to rent to them. He got fined, I don't know how many millions of dollars. He gets in trouble. It was a high-profile case. In other words, the world knew about it. And he still was allowed to maintain his business status and his status as the owner of the Clippers. And nobody dumped on the guy. And not only that, he then started making donations to the NAACP chapter in Los Angeles, which not only accepted his money, but gave him an award for Citizen of the Year. This is the same guy who, while getting that award, was dating a woman who was at least half black. She clearly is brown, if you look at her.
Sure, yeah.
And he treated her with such disrespect, not in terms of how he bought her or didn't buy her stuff. He bought her lots of stuff. I mean, I would frankly call her a hooker and at this point an extortionist, because she's threatening to release even more tapes, probably as a quid pro quo if the guy doesn't give her something else. But I digress. He's giving her stuff, knowing she's black, and telling her she can't hang around with black people because black people aren't good enough to be hanging around with white people, and he's getting prizes from the NAACP. I mean, if the NAACP and black women who are dating guys like this don't object to that kind of racism, why on earth would anyone expect racism to be eradicated or condemned or morally, socially unacceptable? This is what I wrote my piece about, that if money allows people to be racist, what are we doing complaining about racism? Because it isn't about the moral problem at all. It's just a matter of economics.
Yeah.
So if you're rich and you want to be a racist, it's okay. You just have to pay the NAACP. If you want to be racist to your black girlfriend, it's okay so long as you buy her a Ferrari. That is an American sickness, and that's what I write about in my piece.
Wendy Murphy's here. What about the response of the NBA? You ban him for life. This is going to end up in the courts for probably years to come. Not sure how long Mr. Sterling will stay on earth. He's quite elderly as it is right now. But what about the reaction of the NBA?
Well, look, he could live for another 20 years, and I don't care.
Yeah.
that a guy is old. You still have to deal with it. I have prosecuted a guy in his mid-80s for repeat offense, sex offenses against a child. And when he came in his wheelchair and said, you know, I'm too old to go to jail, the judge said, oh, no, you're not. Not at all. Take yourself and your walker straight to jail. So I don't care about his age. And what I do care about in terms of the question of the role of the NBA and how complicated these ownership things are, in the sense that, you know, it's a private industry, it's a very wealthy industry, they get to govern themselves, and if they choose, as Commissioner Silver did, choose to punish an owner for bad social behavior, it could end up in the courts, primarily because it's never been done before. You know, the commissioners tend to punish people when they gamble or cheat, you know, use whatever, but they don't tend to punish for socially unacceptable or moral transgressions. And this was a big step, I thought, for Silver, and I think a good step and an expression of leadership. Now, a lot of people said he really did it for the money, because he would have taken a financial hit had he not punished the guy severely, but I don't know, there could be a backstory here that's all about the sale of the team. Somebody somewhere wants to buy the team. In order to buy the team, they had to get rid of Sterling, and perhaps, you know, they lassoed this girl to Steviano, the wink-wink girlfriend-slash-hooker. They lassoed her to make the tapes so they could expose him and force him to sell the team. There could be just money behind the scenes. Who knows? But it's still important that somebody at the head of the NBA is making a declaration about socially unacceptable behavior, because now the standard has changed. And my hope is that sometime in the future, when a guy beats the hell out of his wife or girlfriend, and he's either a player or an owner, that some commissioner of one of these leagues will do the same thing, unacceptable. And believe me, I'm going to press him. What's worse, words about blacks or a black eye on any colored woman's face? Right?
Absolutely.
This is the thing that I think we do need to do, is pressure wealthy people to make statements about socially unacceptable behavior. And then the other thing that matters about the NBA is, if they're going to make these statements about a guy like Donald Sterling, they got to stick to it, you know, and not just now turn this into a wink, wink, nod, we are happy now, he's made amends, he sold the team, let's put this all behind us. No, you don't put this behind you. You make a declaration further about not just racism and not just hatred and the fact that hatred can be silenced with cash. You have to say the industry of sports as a bazillion-dollar problem in America. And I don't mean that it's always a bad thing to have sports making money. Sports is a nice thing in America and in Canada, and it makes, you know, it makes people money, but it's also a nice form of entertainment, except when they're beating the hell out of each other, but that's another story for another time. But if you're going to have an industry that's making a lot of money and at the top of the echelon of who's making decisions, these are, we're letting human beings, the likes of which include people like Donald Sterling, we're letting them purchase other human beings for entertainment. We're letting people like Donald Sterling buy players, buy human beings, put them on the courts, subject them to whatever the conditions are, and make them provide entertainment as a quid pro quo for a salary, because they're going to make a fortune from those of us who buy the tickets and the advertisers and so forth. When you allow people to purchase human beings for money and then make money off of their performance, you're walking into dangerous territory. It is not far from the very form of slavery that we've condemned in this country as just inhumane and undignified. I'm not sure where to draw the line. I just think the purchasing of human beings was in the mind of Donald Sterling. He purchases people to play basketball. He clearly was purchasing his black girlfriend slash hooker, whatever she is, to do God knows what in bed, and giving her Ferraris as a quid pro quo. That is inhumane, to treat human beings like that, as if they are corporate assets, widgets, things to perform services for your pleasure. That is a sickness in America.
Wendy Murphy's here. We're talking about Donald Sterling. One more question. The way that the media has covered this since it came out, I'm not sure if it was TMZ that broke the story or whoever it was, and we hear and we see lots of stories, Wendy, about the celebrity or the politician or the whoever that was caught on tape. Sterling caught on tape. Is this caught on tape mentality something that the media needs to do more of so we can expose people like Sterling?
Well, you know, that's a really hard question for me to answer, because on the one hand, I like it when women who've been victims of domestic violence or rape or, you know, children who are being abused behind closed doors make tapes that they can then bring to law enforcement and say, please help me, this is happening. And, if they didn't have the tapes, they might not be believed. So I like the fact that there is this way of uncovering secret bad behavior, especially with today's technology where, you know, you can do it with a pen. You can literally buy a pen with a camera. And for desperately terrified children, you know, getting information on a video pen is great. It's an empowering device for them. On the other hand, and it's a big other hand, I really hate extortionists. Probably more so than I hate people who secretly record things. And it's a tough, very complicated double-edged sword for people like me who want to expose bad behavior but not reward extortion. This woman, V. Stiviano, as much as you might want to feel grateful that she released tapes showing this man to be an unapologetic racist, I don't like her any more than anybody else in the picture. I mean, she is not sympathetic. She's not a heroine. She's nothing to be celebrated, because she strikes me as a hooker who sold her gender and her race for cash and turned into an extortionist, potentially for more cash. That is not a human being that deserves to be celebrated or rewarded. So I'm torn. This is a very tough case for me. She is not a good person. He may be a terrible person too, but it's quite possible that the one who made the recordings of Donald Sterling is a worse person than he is.
Yeah, exactly. Wendy, one last question. Where this goes, the players, the fans, the whoever, I want to think about the kids a little bit, because the kids look at sports figures, sports teams, and they put them on that that pedestal. That's their favorite. What has this done to the kids out there that idolize the sports figures and the sports teams?
Well, you know, if my experience is any indication, and it may not be, the young people I've talked to about this story think that Donald Sterling is kind of a cartoon character, and they don't get it. And that's the wonder of generations, evolution, you know, progress in ideas. Look, Donald Sterling was 80 when this broke, which means he was born and raised, frankly, at a time when blacks were not equal in this country. You could say that that affected his mental software, not an excuse for his behavior, but we don't have people born into that mental software anymore, and that's a good thing. So I think young people hearing this story think that it's a Saturday Night Live skit. You know, it's almost so beyond the pale that it doesn't stick or make people upset or, I don't know. I mean, the people that I've talked to, both young and old, have just as likely commented on why isn't anybody noticing his mistreatment of the woman, the right. black woman that was his girlfriend or whatever she was. Why aren't people talking about his mistreatment of her as a woman instead of just the comments he made about her not socializing with blacks? In other words, gender kind of got lost in all of this. The profound gender discrimination got lost in all of this. And that's been more of a topic of conversation, not so much gender discrimination is a worse problem, but why the zero attention to gender when you consider that that woman is a black woman being discriminated against in all kinds of ways. Her role in this as a victim of his discrimination has really been invisible, and that speaks volumes about the double marginalization of black women in the race-gender tension in this country. So, you know, I have to say that I have a lot of hope for young people, because no matter what we tell them the issue is, they hear things differently. And the young people that I've talked to, including my law students, have, on average, kind of rolled their eyes at Donald Sterling, maybe because they think it's so out of line with what they know to be their world, that they don't think it's worth spending a lot of energy on, but also because they've noticed the more subtle problems related to how a man like that functions, that it isn't that a guy like that, usually, if he's such an unapologetic racist, has a whole lot more going on that's problematic in other ways that aren't getting enough attention. Racism, in other words, sometimes gets more attention than it may deserve from a guy like that.
Wendy, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Mine too. Take care, Dana. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy. She's a former sex crimes prosecutor, DA, law professor, and she tells it like it is. And Donald Sterling, well, just look at the story. Look at the person. Look at his history. The NBA, well done. Donald Sterling, 80 years old, maybe he thinks he's doing what happened to blacks when he was growing up, and that's his ideology as far as dealing with blacks. Maybe he knows no better. I don't think so. I think he's a rich, snobby old racist who probably should have never owned a basketball team right from the get-go, but nevertheless does. Will this story be over anytime soon? No. I worry about the kids, because the kids who idealize these types of sports owners, sports teams, who look at race relations the way they are now, all you have to hear is some of the rap music that's out there right now. This takes it back a bit. They're not all Donald Sterlings out there, no matter what some of the Jesse Jacksons and the others say. But the ones like Donald Sterling certainly need to be in a position where they're not in a position to be held to a higher esteem and own a sports team. old racists like that should be put out to pasture, so to speak. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.